This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, you know, before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the rise of outlaw country music and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision in her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Hey, I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the St. Jude kids. St. Jude's doing incredible work fighting childhood cancer. And because of donations like the ones that you give, families never receive a bill ever from St. Jude for treatment, travel, housing, food, none of that. Help St. Jude stop childhood cancer. Become a partner in hope. Get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. It's going to look great on you. So join all the doctors, researchers, and me in this fight. All right, text the word Bobby. It's only 6 numbers to 785-833. Again, text the word Bobby to just these 6 numbers, 785-833.
Hello, and welcome back to the Top 8 BobbyCast Interviews of 2021, Part 2. I am Mike D, producer of the BobbyCast, and Bobby and I have hand-selected the best interviews we did this year. This is Part 2, so if you missed Part 1, just go back an episode and check that out. Or if you just want to hear the top four, you're in the right place because these are the best interviews we did on the BobbyCast this year. And this is based on episode downloads, reaction we had on social media. So I'll count these down, give you some behind the scenes that went into recording these episodes and what I kind of have to do as a producer of this podcast. So let's get right into it. At number four, we went with Jimmy Allen. Now we had Jimmy Allen back on in 2018 before he ever had a number one. And Jimmy is one of the nicest people in country music, and he's a very busy guy. And this was before Dancing with the Stars this year, before winning Best New Artist. And what I love about Jimmy is that he always comes in with the best stories. Right when he sits down, Bobby asks him one question, and it immediately leads to a great conversation. And we had so many tweets and DMs when this episode came out. So at number four is Jimmy Allen.
Here with Jimmy Allen, which I was looking at some of the track listing for Betty James, and I'm always curious at the process and asking people much cooler than yourself, no offense, much cooler than yourself to much do something cooler. With you, because sometimes I have to ask people cooler, way cooler than me to do stuff with me, and I'm always a little weird about it. How do you ask, for example, let's do the song now, you and Brad Paisley, you have a song together. Yeah. It's the song out of radio, Freedom Was a Highway. How does that ask go? Do you do it or does your people do it?
Man, so I kind of did it myself. It kind of happened because I was, Brad had texted me one night. It was like, hey, after you play the opera tonight, come by the house. He said, Darius is coming. And he said, Bill Shatner is here. I was like, who the hell is Bill Shatner?
William Shatner.
I was like, you know, people my age, we know him from Unsolved Mysteries. I didn't know who, I've never heard him called Bill Shatner before. So I went over there and I get there. Tim McGraw's outside peeing out in front of the house. So we go in, and we're just talking, me, Tim, Brad, and Darius. And I'm sitting here looking like, how did I get in this room? How much money these dudes are worth? Like,
right.
A lot. So then we grab the guitars and start playing. And then Tim was like, yo, we should do a song together. He said, Jimmy, here's my number. Text me. Let's do a song. I was like, now listen, I'm the dude that if you give me your number and you say text me to do something, I'm going to text you. So I went to L.A. like 2 days after that, and I wrote Made for These. And I texted to Tim. I was like, hey, what do you think about this song? He's like, dude, I love it. Let's do it. Then Brad, I had Freedom written like a year and a half before that. I wrote it with Ash and this guy named Matt Rogers. And he was like, I love it. I was like, perfect. And then the Darius and Charlie song, man. I actually had another song I wanted to do with Darius and Charlie. But it was like a drinking song, and Darius like, bro, we can't have the first song we do with Charlie Pride be a drinking song. I was like, good point. So the day after Kobe died, I was writing. It was me, my bass player, Tate Howe, who is my first signing to my publishing company. He's dope. Kerry Barlow and Brandon Day. We wrote it the day after Kobe died. And just think about life, man. You know, like, life throws stuff at you. Like, Kobe was probably one of the most motivated people I ever knew. Like, every conversation I had with Kobe, I just left feeling more motivated. Like, you know, what can't I do? What people say I can't do, I got to go do it. So that's what kind of how that song came about. So I called Charlie, gave it to Darius, and they were like, yeah. So that's kind of how that comes. I just reached out to everybody, and after I got everybody's yes, then I called the labels like, hey, I'm going to do this collab EP. I already got the artist. They all said yes. So I kind of did the work before I even went.
What about Nelly?
Nelly, he was in town. I saw him. I was walking the same building I was walking to for me, and he was walking out. I texted my manager, yo, Nelly's in town. Can you find out why? He was like, yeah, sure. So he finds out why Nelly's in town. He's in town writing. Then he said, hey, Nelly can write with you tonight at 9. But we wrote that like 2019. And then we had a show the next day in Minnesota. I was like, all right, it's a hard decision. Do I stay and write with Nelly or do I get on the tour bus? Because me and my band, we hang out on the tour bus. We play PlayStation. So do I play PlayStation or do I write with Nelly? So I wrote with Nelly. And then I just flew to Minnesota the next day. That's how that one worked.
Let's see. So that I was going to play some of Made for These, which is you and McGraw.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, play me a clip of this. So if Tim were to send, because I'm assuming you guys did not record them at the same time,
mm-mm,
right? Like he went and did his thing and he sent it back to you.
Yep.
If he would have sent something back that wasn't your vision and heck, you didn't love, would you have said, can we cut this a little different?
Or Oh, yeah.
Oh, you would have.
Oh, yeah. Because I feel like when you're creating music, man, you want it to be the best. And I feel like a lot of times people work with legends and stuff like that and they just like, okay, we'll just take it because they're on it. But I still want it to be good. You know what I mean? And knowing Tim's capability, like, he killed that song. I remember Tim told me, he said, dude, you're going to make me, like, sing for real on this song. I said, why? He said, because you're singing for real, so I have to sing for real. He killed it. Like, he did his thing. But, yeah, if I didn't feel it was done right, you know what I mean? Like, hey, man, you mind redoing this part or redoing that part? The only thing he could say is no or screw you. But he killed it.
And I think he would. He'd say no or screw you if he didn't feel like. I think people are going to kill me if I don't follow up on you saying the times that you've spoken with Kobe. How did you meet Kobe Bryant?
Man, I met Kobe at a Lakers game backstage. Around near the locker room area. And just, shucks, I think I was.
A game when he was playing or after he retired?
Oh, he was playing. He was playing. I think it was 2000 and, shucks, when I meet Kobe, 2005? No, 2006 or 2007.
That long ago?
Yeah.
How did you get in the locker room in 2006?
Man, I'm going to tell you something about me. I used to sneak in a lot of places, bro. Like, I've snuck into Grammy parties. I've snuck into CSAC Awards. I've snuck into the CMAs before I got a record deal. Because this is the thing. When you're a black guy with cowboy boots on and a leather jacket and you act like you know where you're going, nobody stops you. So I was sitting like four rows up behind the Lakers bench. And I saw people just going backstage to get drinks. So I had a cup in my hand. And I just followed another group of black guys. I think they were like rappers or something. I don't know. But nobody stopped me. Then I was back there just hanging out, acting like I'm on my phone, talking. Kobe walked by, said, hey, what's up to him? And
how do you say, hey, what's up to him just walking by, though?
Like, I was like, Kobe, what up? Good to see you, bro. Act like I knew. He said, hey, what's up, man? He was like, what's your name again? I said, Jimmy.
Again, because he thinks he probably met you at some point.
Exactly. So I saw him there. Then I saw him at a few events before we bumped into each other. Like, I think we've had about over 15, 20 conversations.
Did it ever get to the point where you guys just saw each other like, Jimmy, Kobe?
Oh, yeah. It got to that point.
Was it after you had started to get heat or get success that it was a bit of a peer-to-peer we're both in?
Nah, it was more just he saw me everywhere. Like, at different events he was at in L.A., I was there. A couple events in Miami, he was there, I was there. Like, I used to, like, purposely put myself in places to meet people. Because I feel like if you want to be successful, you got to surround yourself with successful people. That's why I was killing myself when I first moved to town and moved to Brentwood. Because I knew most people lived in Brentwood. So I ran into people at the gym, the grocery store, at restaurants, and I would just talk to them.
I was watching you play in one of the celebrity – maybe it was – because I don't think they had an All-Star game last year, but the year before. Were you playing in the celebrity All-Star game?
No, that was Kane. I played in the celebrity game
I watched you a few years ago. All my years are done.
Yeah.
Everything's –
It was this Monster Inc. celebrity game I did with Floyd Mayweather.
Yes.
And like T.O. and Gronk and all of them, yeah.
All the celebrity games to me are the same,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know the difference. And
yeah.
I just remember seeing you play.
Yeah.
And I was like, dang, Who was the best celebrity basketball player on the court that night?
Terrell Owens.
Well, okay, but he played, what, Tennessee State?
Yeah, he's good.
Is that where, or Tennessee Chattanooga?
Chattanooga or something.
Yeah.
He was good.
He was a college basketball player. Remove him. Remove anyone that played basketball at a high level. I'll ask you this. Who is the best celebrity basketball player you've played with or against that wasn't a ball player?
That wasn't a ball player? Probably Matt Stell.
I beat him out here.
Matt Stell can hoop when he turns it on.
I tell you this, though. I only beat him because we were shooting and hustling. If he was... He's 6'6 and plays like a guard.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, when Matt turns it on, he can hoop. Kane can hoop. I still think I'm better than both of them, for sure.
Do you guys get competitive when you're with each other to the point where it'll get a bit chippy at times?
Not really chippy, because, you know, we're out here playing, but at some point in the game, we both want to win. So it's like when the game kind of gets close, well, you'll see people, like, really turn up. Guys that love ball and, like, play ball and competitive, whether they're good or not, they kind of – turns it up a little bit. Even Gator turns it up out there.
Yeah, Gator's competitive.
He hustles. I call him, like, I say he's an undersized white Dennis Rodman.
An undersized white Dennis Rodman.
Mm-hmm. Dude rebounds like nobody I've ever
really?
Seen before. And his energy is crazy.
He does have crazy
energy. He's scrappy.
Yeah.
He's the type of person you want on your team.
He's oddly a really good athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's close to 50 now.
Yeah.
Something like that.
He's at least 72 for sure.
Yeah, what is the Disney kick about? Because every time on Instagram, not recently. You've been pandemic, though. I've seen you out there.
Yeah. About five times. I was just there a couple days ago. I'm going again Sunday.
What's the deal? What's that rooted in?
So I fell in love with Walt. I told you, like, everyone that's motivated, that comes from nothing, I look up to. That goes to you, Kevin Hart, Walt Disney. Like, this guy had his first character, Oswald, stolen. Came back, had nothing, took loans out, bet on himself. Created Mickey, who he was going to name Mortimer the Mouse. I'm glad they were Mickey. But he just showed that, man, you bet on yourself. You work your butt off. You continue to work, even in the face of no, and eventually you'll get where you want to go. So for me, that was the first thing. I was attracted to who Walt was, like his determination. And then my family started going. It's the last place me and my grandma went before she died. I had my daughter's baby reveal there. I got engaged there. So it's something that's been a part of my family for a long time. So I love it.
What do you do when you go? Are you riding rides or are there certain experiences that you like to hit at certain times?
Yeah. So the first thing I always do is go to Magic Kingdom. You got to set the mood right. You know, then I ride a Carousel of Progress. I'm a classic Disney fan. Then I'll take a day. We'll do the VIP tours. We could just jump to the front of lines, just ride rides. After that, man, we chill. Go to Animal Kingdom, walk around, go to Epcot, eat, drink, hang out. They got different festivals that they have come through. Like right now, it's Flower and Garden to like July 3rd. And after that, they got...
He knows the whole calendar of Flower and Garden.
Yeah, then after that, they got Food and Wine. So like they have all their countries, but then they bring in other countries too. And they have different food stuff set up. And I love food, bro.
For me, I never got to go to Disney as a kid. You know, we didn't even go on vacation.
Yeah. But I went first time in 2012. I went as an adult.
Yeah, me too. I went for the first time as an adult too. Yeah. And so I remember since I work for ABC... And Disney owns ABC. We were after a shoot one day, and a guy comes up and goes, "Hey, you know you can go to Disney whenever you want, and VIP. Like they give you a guide,
mm-hmm.
and you can go, and like they'll hook you up." And I was like, "Really?" I said, "Well, I never been." Mm-hmm. They're like, "Well, then," he said, "it's gonna ruin you because if you go and we send you with the Disney VIP, you're gonna cut every line.
Yeah,
but you should do it." And I was out, and we were shooting Idol, and I had a day off, which is very rare out there. And I said, "You know what? Screw it. I'm gonna go." And so I go, and, you know, the woman shows up. She's in, like, the plaid skirt, mm-hmm. and she knows the history, and you're finding the little Mickey Mouses all over. And I'm, like, a wide-eyed kid because I've never been before. And so I start to feel guilty because it's a Saturday, and we are cutting 2.5-hour lines.
Yeah.
We're just walking around people.
Literally just walking
around. I didn't feel so guilty. I stopped. I felt guilty, but I still would still go to the front of the line.
Oh, for sure.
It was hot, and, you know, I don't want to sweat. So we get there, and she says to me, she goes, "Hey, we're going to walk with another group of VIP people. We're going to take a little side under trail."
Mm-hmm.
And she's like,
"This is Disneyland in L.A.?"
"This is Disneyland." And she says, "So we're going to take this little trip. It's not a big deal. You're going to run into some people." But they were – listen, I'm not famous. But they're so
– But you are.
No, but I'm not. But they're so worried about people bothering famous people.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, "Don't worry about it. Anybody you're near is going to be – you know, someone who's not going to bother you." And I'm like, "All right, I'm worried about that anyway, but okay." So we go down, and there's this small lady, long hair, and she's up ahead of me, and she's just kind of bebopping around, a lot of energy. And I walk up beside her, and she's kind of got ripped clothes on, ripped jeans, and I'm just walking, and I look over, and that small, older lady was Steven Tyler. who I had met a couple times when he was in town and was extremely nice in town.
He was my judge when I was on Idol.
Was he?
Yeah.
You went during that
yeah,
phase.
Yeah, him, Randy, and J-Lo.
Well, he was so nice to me here, but I didn't want to bother him or expect Steven Tyler of Aerosmith to remember me.
Mm-hmm.
So we're walking beside each other. He goes, hey, what's happening, man? He just sees some guy, guy walking next to him. I'm like, hey, man, how are you? And he goes, Bobby Bones. And I was like, are you kidding me? Steven Tyler recognizes me at Disney World with no prompt whatsoever.
Yeah.
So my Disney experience was pretty good, too.
Heck yeah, Steven Tyler, bro.
And Steven Tyler was there.
Have you gone to Disney World in Florida yet?
I went and had dinner there because I had a friend who now works at Apple, Michael Bryan, who had programmed there before. And he was like, hey, I'll get you into like the greatest food place. Mm-hmm. But I haven't like done all the park stuff there.
Bro. See, we do it now. So I went to, my problem was in 2012, I like worked three jobs and saved up enough, and I took my mom and two of my sisters. We went. But then I went to Disneyland after that. But Disneyland is so small compared to Disney World. And now I remember we were just there a couple weeks ago. A week ago. And we got the VIP tour again. And then they have two sets of VIP tours. They have some VIP tours where you get in the fast pass lane. And if you're a quote-unquote celebrity, they take you around the back through the exit, and you literally just hop straight on the ride. And I felt so bad. I'm looking at these lines that are like 2.5 hours, little kids out there waiting and sweating. But I didn't feel bad. You know why? Because I've waited in lines before. When I first went, I was like, you got this, kid. You work hard, man. You'll be here, too. You got this.
You're giving the kids the Kobe talk. They're 2 hours back in line.
Exactly.
Like, man, hang in there. You can do anything.
You got this. I've waited in my lines for 3 hours.
You once turned down a record deal from a label in L.A. that I read was going to give you over $1 million advance.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Now, because... did they want you to be a different kind of artist than you wanted to be, or was it terms of the deal?
Yeah, both. Terms of the deal and the artist. They wanted me and my band to be kind of like a hip-hop version of One Republic. So I wear, when I'm not performing, I'm wearing sweats and sneakers all day. But on stage, I love my boots, love my jeans. They told me they didn't want me to dip. I had to hide my dip can. They wanted the songs to be more hip-hop influenced, to where I do love hip-hop. I include hip-hop, R&B, rock, and all that stuff in my music now. But it's intentional where I place it. They want it to just be heavy hip-hop loop. No live bands, none of that. So I was just like... and then with that advance, I still had to take my money for myself out of it, and then my band. And then I had to, you know, pay for my first album with that. You know, then you got taxes. And then so when it really dwindles down... a lot.
Then you got to pay it back, right?
I mean,
the word advance is where it's at.
It's a loan.
Yeah.
You know, so for me, it was just like, nah, you know, but for me, it really just came down to music and creativity and kind of what I wanted to do. You know, I have whether other people see it or not, I kind of have a vision kind of for like my life, music, TV, film, radio, all that stuff. So if something doesn't align with my vision, no matter how great the opportunity might seem to someone else, it's just not for me. You know what I mean?
Is it hard to, and I could probably understand and have empathy for the situation for you, is it hard now, growing up with nothing, to turn down really great paying opportunities because they're right on the fence of feeling right or just chasing the money?
Man, it's hard to turn it down sometimes. But I feel like you can devalue yourself a lot of times and just saying yes to everything, no matter how big the money is. Because every time you sign on to do something, you're giving a piece of yourself away. So my thing is, if I give a piece of myself away, is it worth it? You know what I mean? Does it align with my vision, career? Does it align with my vision as a person? Like, morally, does it align with what I want to do?
So what do you want to do musically? Like, what right now, where are you in your head and what you're trying to do musically?
Not even close. I want to continue to put music out. You know, more. My plan is hopefully one day be able to headline arenas. But that, to me, that's a piece of it.
What about the kind of music you're making?
I love the kind of music I'm making. At some point, knowing me, I'll probably do like a straight, just like Latin slash a reggae album at some point. Just I love Latin music.
Where does that come from? Where does the love of Latin music come from in your life growing up a kid in Delaware?
Man, I listen to everything. Like, my dad only listened to country, my mom only listened to Christian, but I listened to everything growing up. Latin music, you know, blues, rock, hip-hop, R&B, jazz, classical, Broadway. I want to do a full-on musical theater album, like 12 songs of songs that would be in a play. I just love it. So that's why, like, 2022, my plan is to take 4 months off, go to New York, do a Broadway show, do that. We're working on some TV and movies.
Go
stuff
to New
right
York
now.
And do a Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean do? Like Jennifer Nettles, like
yeah.
When they go up and they're just a part of a show and they live up there.
Yeah, part of a show. So it'll take 4 months. My plan is to be Aaron Burr in Hamilton.
Do they know that yet?
They're about to. UTA is working on that right now. But yeah, just gonna take 4 months off. Just gonna be special guest Aaron Burr.
Listen, I know you say off, but I got friends on Broadway. That's opposite off.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not. I mean off from touring music. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 8 shows in 6 days.
Yeah, it's rough.
You know, it is a run. That's cool. Listen, I think sometimes people get frustrated when they see people that want to do a lot of different things because they think people are only able to do a few things well. Do you feel like your label's like at times? Because I can tell you, at times my radio company has been like, hey, why are you doing TV projects? Why are you touring stand-up? Like, how are you able to put all of your effort into radio if you're doing these other things?
And what people don't understand is it's all about expanding the brand.
And to me, it's about filling my cup.
Exactly.
So I'm better at everything. If I feel good, like one of my buds, I'd call him a friend, Deion Sanders, always says, if you look good, you feel good. If you feel good, you play good. If you play good, they pay good.
Exactly.
And if I'm doing things that I love, I'm better at all the things that I'm doing because I feel more fulfilled.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you got any pushback from your people.
Man, I have. You know, I've gotten some pushback from people before. Like, I remember when I was writing this kid's book. Comes out July 13th, by the way. Called My Voice is a Trumpet. They were concerned about that. Well, how's he going to have time to write? I'm fine with music. You know, like the TV and film I want to do, like... you know, there's a show, I can't say it yet, but I'm the musical director now for this new Netflix show that comes out this year. So I'm doing that, you know, doing radio, TV spots, whatever. But for me, it's kind of like I have to do everything I want to do. If I don't, I will go insane. Because I tell people, being a touring country artist is just a piece of what I want to do. Not everything. Now, there's some people, like, that's it for them. They just want to, you know, write country songs, have songs on radio and tour. That's great for them. But for me, it's not. It doesn't matter. I could win every CMA, every ACM, have number ones out of number ones, selling out arenas across the world, and I still wouldn't be happy because that's only a piece of what I want to do. You know what I mean? And again, like I tell people, you have to do what's best for you, what's going to fill you up, you know? And half the people telling me that I shouldn't do it are also people that grew up in two-parent homes with money as a kid.
All right, listen, I'm gonna let you go. Appreciate you coming by. We haven't done this since the very beginning.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Since the very, very beginning, you came to the other place, and we did it upstairs. And
I got the call, I was gonna be on here. I was like, heck yeah, let's go. It's like, it's been a while.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate you, just in general. I think you're great for Nashville, just what you stand for, and to not even country music artists, but to show people, listen, you don't have to just do one thing if you don't just want to do one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can specialize if you want, or you can specialize in a lot of things if you want.
Facts.
So that's cool. All right, Jimmy Allen, at Jimmy Allen. There you go.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. Tecovas.com.
Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, that's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Backrack as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
Moving on to number three, and we're going with Scott Stapp of Creed. I think this is hands down one of the coolest interviews we've ever done, and Bobby and I were both super excited about it. And as a producer of this podcast, I rarely get nervous about guests. I've had the chance to meet everybody in country music to the point to where, you know, it's just somebody coming in for an interview. I'm focused more on what's going to happen once they sit down, that everything's perfect in line. The actual them coming into the studio doesn't make me nervous at all. However, when I was sitting across from Scott Stapp, it made me nervous. And this one was so good. Like, I was so just in it while we were recording it. I was worried something was going to go wrong with the audio. I was going to lose the file. I think I was so relieved when it was over. I hit stop and saved this episode because I was like, this is one of the greatest things that's ever happened in the history of this podcast. And it was also the one that probably took the longest to book. Usually we book all of our guests at the beginning of the month. With this one, I think it was like 3 months out where we had to book Scott Stapp. We were trying to get him on the radio show. We were trying to get them to come in and perform. And then we finally settled, which I think was the best option of having him in on the podcast, because we're able to sit down for an hour and talk about literally everything. So this was awesome. At number three is Scott Stapp, the lead singer of Creed.
All right, well, it's Scott Stapp of Creed. And most of the time when friends come over, they're friends and they're buddies. And I'm like, hey, let's do this because they're promoting something, or it's a fun conversation. But rarely do I get to have someone in that I've been a genuine fan of for 20 years. And so, like, I'm grateful that you took the time to come over here and hang out and let me talk with you. Because, again, I'm a fan, and it's rare for me to get to talk to someone in that capacity.
Man, thank you. That means a lot, bro. Thank you. And it's awesome to be here. Good times.
I was kind of looking back at some of the older, in our younger days, whenever you guys got together, and there's a big Florida State presence in the band.
Right.
Because that's where you guys met to begin with, right?
Yes, yes.
And so you go to Florida State. And what was your idea when you go to college? Like, what did you want to be when you went to Florida State? Because a lot of people don't go to Florida State to go, I want to be in a band and be a big star.
Right. Well, I mean, I'll be honest with you. The only reason that I left Orlando to go to Tallahassee and to end up going to school at Florida State was because I was reading a biography about the Doors and read that Jim Morrison, whom I was a huge fan of and a huge fan of the Doors, went to Florida State. And in my naive 18 or 19-year-old mind at the time, I thought, well, hey, I mean, that's just the way that that you meet musicians and start a band. And
so it was about music.
Yeah. And so I went there with the specific goal of meeting musicians to start a band. And that was the goal.
Did you 100%. Have a major?
Well, I did. It was communications and minor in English. And like, I think I had like three or four minors because I kept changing my major. Like, I think it started out as like philosophy and so I got a lot of minors and, you know, my backup plan, which I didn't really focus on too much, was I was going to go to law school, and do that.
And you've written massive songs with basically everything. I have songwriter friends that have been doing it their whole life. I have written a hit and they're really good. You hadn't done it at all.
Right.
And then you started writing songs and you have so many, like how easily, or was it not easy for you to start writing songs that actually were good, catchy songs with hooks?
You know, I think we wrote probably 7 or 8 songs that, you know, in trying to find our sound. And then we wrote a song called Grip My Soul, which never made a record. Should have, but it didn't make the record. We didn't record it. Or maybe we did record it, but it didn't make the record. That might have been our 8th or 9th song. And I remember when we wrote that song, we all looked at each other, and Mark and I specifically, and we're like, okay, we got it. We figured, this is it. We figured it out. And from that moment on, what you hear on My Prison was written. Literally only probably once we figured out what our sound was, from Grip My Soul to what was recorded on My Own Prison, we probably only wrote 14 songs.
Wow.
And total, since Mark and I were together, maybe 20 songs.
Which is a very low number.
Were the first 20 songs I had ever written in my life.
And that's my point exactly. Like, I have friends that have been doing it for 20 years. They write 60 songs for a record now.
The only thing I can think of, man, is that you know, the artists that I listen to, you know, being U2, also, you know, growing up listening, the only thing that was allowed in my home growing up was Christian rock. Or Christian artists. And so, you know, I would listen to a lot of Take Six, and I think that's who taught me how to sing, because I would sing along with those records and sing every vocal part on that record. And then DC Talk, which is became Toby Mac.
Yeah.
That was allowed in my house. And then U2, because the same thing that people ended up doing with Creed that were in Christian homes, saying, wait, they're a Christian band, Mom and Dad, even though Creed wasn't an official Christian band, just like U2 is not a Christian band, but Bono's a Christian. And so I snuck Joshua Tree, got it into my house, and was able to listen to that by telling my parents that they were a Christian band. But I think those bands that I listened to growing up, Striper was another one that was a jam in my house. But I think all that was just imprinted in my brain. I think song structure and how to write songs based on those records was just imprinted in my brain. Mark the same way. Mark was, he was much different than me in that Mark knew what he wanted to do when he was probably 10 or 11 years old. Mark knew he wanted to be in a rock band, play guitar and write songs and be a singer and a guitar player. He knew. At least that's how I recall it. And so he knew all these bands that I had never heard of. He probably knew hundreds and hundreds of songs on guitar, you know, by learning them on tab and just listening and playing them. So of course that taught him song structure and taught him. So I think me just hearing that in him, I think we just inherently knew structure and how to put a song together. And then it just came out once we got together. We didn't think too much about it. We never sat down and thought, let's write a radio song or we need to do this. We were just like, hey, that's the verse, that's the chorus, that's this. You know, we never put any pressure on ourselves. We just wrote what made us feel good. Because in the beginning, we were just playing for us. You know what I mean?
My Own Prison, I'm going to play few of these hooks here. Here is actually My Own Prison, 1997. That's it. Whenever I hear a song from like when I mean, like I feel like I felt then. Music does that.
Right.
Like when you hear a song that reminds you of a really big part of your life, you for a second you feel that part of your life again.
Yeah, yeah.
And this record does that to me. This, yeah. This is the record in general. Torn. Here's a clip of Torn. What's This Life For? Which was a rock number one for you guys.
Yep.
Was this a big separator for you guys? Did this one turn you guys from a national known band to like a, whoa, here they come?
I think, you know, My Own Prison went, all four of our first singles went number one at rock. And I think it was a build. And then, you know, My Own Prison was our first video that was on MTV and VH1. And then What's This Life For? I think was our second video that was on MTV and VH1. And it was more of a, it had more of a, appeal to a wider audience. What's This Life For did, I think.
That's when I felt other people were knowing about you guys.
Right.
When What's This,
right.
Because The Edge Dallas, I would have a friend record, take a cassette tape, because kids now don't know.
Yeah.
You do record, play, pause, and then you undo pause.
Right.
And you record what's on the radio.
Right.
And I'd have a friend send it to me. And he was like, you got to hear Creed. What's This Life For? I remember, I was like, I already been knowing about Creed.
Right.
But I felt like that song.
Yeah, I definitely think that that just, you know, expanded it even further. And I think the video had a lot to do with that, too. And I think it was really palatable, you know, to a wider audience. And I think we began to see our audience by the time What's This Life For? And then once One, the song One became a single and had its time, our audience really expanded from. And was a mix of men and women. And initially, it was just, you know, dudes, based on our first two singles, you know, into heavy, you know, heavy, aggressive rock. But those two songs showed a different side of the band and began to really open up our audience. And then, you know, the next record, you know, with Higher. And
did you feel the rocket ship? Like, for the first record, you make it, you don't spend a lot of money on it, but you're hustling, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got fake representatives going to record stores.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you are in the hustle.
Right.
Do you feel the rocket ship, or do you just realize, oh boy, we're on it now?
We expected it. We were so, or at least I did. I had this blind confidence, and I had these blinders on, and I just thought that it was going to happen. I just had such belief in the music that we were creating. And then once we made the CD, and then once the record label started coming down, I just thought that, hey, here it is. We're going to be playing arenas soon. That's what happens. That's what happens when you get a record deal and you get on the radio. You play arenas. I had no idea that that was only the beginning. And the chances of you, you know, even making it past your first single were slim to none. You know, I was so naive. But I think that was actually a benefit to me at the time, because it took away any fear or doubt or anything that could stand in the way of me, you know, achieving, and giving what I needed to give, from my standpoint to make it happen. And I think it was contagious, to the guys in the band. And we all just had this belief, in what we were doing We didn't think it would turn out any other way.
With you guys having your music already made and knowing who you were as a band, did that make your first deal easier to actually know what you wanted and not get ripped off?
Well, here's another funny story, or not funny story, but we almost didn't have a record deal. We had literally every major label interested, and then one by one, they started bowing out.
Because?
Don't know. They just, they're interested, they're down, they're talking with our managers, their meetings, they're talking with our law, big New York lawyer that we had. They got everybody signed, you know. And one by one, they would bail. And then it came down to Atlantic Records and the two Knicks that we were talking to. And we were in their offices, meetings, New York back, and we were 100% sure that you know, it was going to be Atlantic Records. And, you know, negotiations were going on, the whole nine yards. I think they ended up signing a band instead of us called 7 Mary 3.
And cumbersome, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we were like, oh my God, what are we going to do?
Why was everybody dropping? Do you know?
I have no idea. And then this little company, never signed a band before. A woman named Diana Meltzer and her husband, Alan Meltzer, they had just started a label called Wind Up Records. And somehow, I think through our lawyer, our Blue Collar Records CD got in Diana Meltzer's hands. And she heard it, and she was 100% convinced that she had to sign this band. She had to sign this band. So she told her husband, Alan, I'm going to Tallahassee, and I'm signing this band, whether you come with me or not. He came. He ended up listening to the CD. He loved it. They came. You know, it was so funny. I remember looking in the crowd, and, you know, there wasn't that many people there at that particular time. They looked like they were in the mafia. You know, there was this little guy in an all black suit, you know, New York looking guy and his wife in all black. And we were like, whoa, who are these two mafia people in the crowd? And they were standing in the center and they were just rocking out, you know? And then our managers came and said, there's some record company folks that want to meet with you guys, afterwards. So we went to this bar next door and it had like a rooftop bar, and we went up there and we talked, and they said, we want to sign you. And this is right after we had, you know, been basically passed on by everybody else, and we had no other option. And looking back, it was the greatest thing that could ever happen to us, because this man was a very successful businessman and he was starting a new business, and we got all the attention from his company, and he did not want to fail. And he was a gambler. We didn't learn that till later on in life that he was a gambler. But he put all his resources into the band. But again, we had no other option. So we took it, and you know, again, naive, but he knew what he was doing. And so we signed with little Wind Up Records, the engine that could, the rest is history.
Did you guys make any money off the first record after signing with them because it did so well?
Yeah, money started coming in. Yeah, I mean, we didn't have a very good deal. It was a bad deal.
What about your publishing from writing the song? Did you get paid from that differently?
We got paid. No, we got publishing. We got recording. We got royalties. We just got a tiny advance and just probably, you know, your basic crappy record deal that was probably pretty standard in 1997. You know, I mean, our publishing deal, we still owned, you know, the vast majority of our publishing, of course, and then had the typical, probably standard record deal. But the record, you know, went 6 times platinum, I believe. And so we definitely, you know, recouped, because they used our demo, man. They
just used the record you spent $6,000 on.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we had nothing to recoup except, you know, a couple music videos, and maybe some tour support early on. And so, yeah, you know, our lives changed really quick, you know.
What is that like? You talk about a rocket ship when your lives change so quickly.
Yeah.
Do you go crazy or are you scared?
It was happening so fast, and it was so awesome, and it was such a high and so exciting, and our dreams were coming true. We were just enjoying every minute of it, man. Without the thought of it could ever end, you know, we were just caught up in it.
Did you guys get a plane?
Eventually, yeah. After Human Clay, we had a plane. We had a G5.
Oh, come on.
You know, I mean, yeah, man. I mean, it
but went, Human Clay was so big.
Yeah,
like,
man.
It was next level. Like, yeah. When Higher comes out, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
I mean, just that drum part and you singing, like, that to me personifies that whole, like, year 2000, like, time period in music.
Yeah.
I mean, Higher was, and here's, we'll play a clip of Higher in case you've been living under a rock, or you're 12, could be 12.
Right,
listening
right.
To this. Was this another level for you guys with the song?
Yeah, this took us to another level. It took us higher, pun intended. And then, you know, there was another song on this record, What If, that was tied in with the Scream 3 movie. And so we did a video with all the Scream 3, you know, actors, and that also, you know, to have that title track for a soundtrack and the whole movie machine behind that gave us exposure to, you know, another greater portion of the world and then higher, and then, you know, and then the grand slam that just took it, you know, to the stratosphere was Arms Wide Open, which came later.
I remember vividly that heartbeat, and I don't know if it was a radio version or the album version, but it would be like,
yeah.
And then, well, I just heard that. That heartbeat still sits with me, like, doop. When that song comes out, because that was a number one pop song, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's you beating everybody.
Right.
Again, it had to be just another notch of what is happening with our life right now.
We were in it and enjoying it and just living it. And like I said earlier, let me just speak for me. I thought that's what was supposed to happen to a band when they got a record deal and got on the radio. I didn't realize until years later that that's not what happens to every band that gets a record deal and gets on the radio. But in that moment, I did. So I thought everything that was happening was just what was supposed to happen. You know what I mean?
What would you go back and tell that kid, though, now?
Oh, man, I could tell that kid a lot. man, appreciate the people around you. Let them know, even though you may appreciate them, let them know on a regular basis. You know, I was so caught up in, you know, I had a lot of anxiety. That's one issue that I dealt with, you know, and so every day that we had a big show in front of an arena crowd or wherever, you know, I was nervous all day long. And so I would kind of isolate myself because I was just nervous and didn't want to mess up and whatnot. And so I would tell that guy, hey, chill, man, and just appreciate the people around you more and let them know, you know. And I did periodically, but I would do more. Also spend more time nurturing all the relationships that you make in this business. You know, I was so caught up in what I had to do and in Creed and in writing the songs. And, you know, that I think this peripheral things I didn't pay enough attention to that, you know, as a more mature human being now, I realize are so important. I mean, it takes a team. You know, it wasn't just the band that was doing everything. It's the team. And so, you know, I think I would definitely, and also I would have told myself, you know, to look at it. This is a job too. You know what I mean? And it's not just one big party. It's, you know, and so definitely, have a lot of things to say to my younger self, about relationships, about taking care of myself mentally and physically, and just appreciating every moment and the people around me, like I said, and preserving and nurturing, those relationships despite what I was going through, at the time.
Would you get nervous when a record would come out? Because, you know, My Own Prison, probably not, because you hustled. But then after it's a success and Human Clay is about to come out, or Weather is about to come out, are you like, well, we got to beat the last one? Or are you just going, let's just go, fire them off?
We were in such a rapid motion from making a record, promoting singles, tour, right back in the studio. We wrote Human Clay on tour because we only had like 10 or 11 songs to play. And so we were like, we got to write some more songs. So we were playing, you know, Say I and Faceless Man and some other songs off of Human Clay, eventually Arms Wide Open, and probably even Higher, live prior to recording them on the album. And so, you know, we kind of would see how the fans would react. You know, they were getting positive reactions. And so we weren't thinking about failure. We never thought about that, looking back. We just were so focused on what we were doing in that moment, and that the doubt didn't come in. We didn't set any expectations on ourselves.
With Arms Wide Open, written about your son.
Yes, it was inspired when I found out I was going to be a father for the first time. Yeah,
is he an adult now?
Yes.
Wild. Like that's when I'm like, how old am I? Yeah. It's one of those moments where you're like, well, crap.
Well, it's funny that you know, my other three children, they all know the song, and it's kind of, you know, it's a family song now. It's for all of you. You know what I mean? It's just inspired by your big brother, but it's for you too.
He's at Scott Stapp on Instagram and TikTok. Creed Instagram is still, you guys are still, social media is still rolling.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man.
Counts are still rolling.
Yes, they are.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
You heard it here. Let's go. I will be front row. All right, Scott, great to see you. Thank you so much.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me, Bobby.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink, shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah, that's what the whole store basically is, fresh leather,
yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events, there is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com. TECOVAS.com.
TECOVAS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, to take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only six numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How do the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer shaped the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed as the Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, that's where they would spur each other and tap into something bigger and something realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bachrach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash alongside a full ensemble cast. Audible invites you to enter the Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/theboarsnest.
At number two, we're going with Reba McEntire. Now, it's crazy to me that Reba just came over to Bobby's house and we recorded an interview with her. And one of the most genuine people I've ever met, and to be an icon in country music, you never expect her to be as nice as she is. But she pulled up, got out of her car, walked in the door, and immediately looked at me and introduced herself. She's like, "Hey, I'm Reba." And this is somebody who everybody can recognize. Reba, a person who does not have to introduce herself at any cost, but she did. It just kind of shows you the person she is. And when it comes to the really successful people in music, they are always the nicest. It's always the icons who are the nicest. People like Garth, Dolly Parton, Reba have all had that same quality when I've had the chance to meet them. And this is another one we've been wanting to do for a very long time. All the stars finally aligned and we were able to sit down with Reba. So here it is at number two, Reba McEntire.
In studio with Reba. At what point did it just turn into just Reba?
Gosh, I think in 94.
Was that a conscious decision by you and your team to go, I want to be an icon, so let's just go with Reba?
Or it was Narvel's idea. Yeah. And I liked it because only when I signed my autograph, I only had to put Reba because I'm lazy.
Now it's kind of weird to hear McEntire.
Yeah, I like it when I'm doing liners and things. I say, hi, I'm Reba McEntire, because that has a cadence for me. But just to do Reba's fine with me, too. I can go with it.
I guess you have to drag out Reba. Hi, I'm Reba. Reba.
Hey, Reba.
Hey, Reba.
Hey, I'm Reba McEntire. It just sounds better to me.
It's funny to see whenever you look at your career, even today, how relevant you are pop culture-wise today. I'm watching Ted Lasso, and they're like, hey, we left the tickets under Reba McEntire.
Yeah.
And so that itself, and we watched that episode, I think, 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Did you know that was going to be in that show at all?
No, I was sitting there with Riddler, my dog, and I was sitting there watching TV, and Roy Kent, my favorite character of that whole show, comes up and says, I think you're holding a ticket for Reba McEntire. I went, Riddler, did you hear that? I was thrilled to pieces.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Marnie said the same thing. She was sitting there with her dog, Cooper, so it was fun.
The same kind of thing, because I'm on TikTok a lot when, you know, I'm a survivor. And it's everybody doing, like, their little household things. You know, someone, you know, throws away the trash. I'm a survivor. Yeah. So that became, and it still is a huge, you know, TikTok trend. Did that come out of nowhere for you, too? And did someone come up and go, Reba, all of a sudden this song is massive on TikTok?
Yeah. Yeah, I think Justin was the one. He sent it over to me, Justin McIntosh. And he said, look at this. Look what's going on. And I said, well, that's pretty cool. I said, these kids weren't even born probably when it was out the first time. And he said, we need to do one. So we did. And then it just got bigger and bigger. Very flattering.
It's one, for a few weeks, it was the most, the thing that I had seen the most. Now what's odd is that Neon Moon is having its minute TikTok too now.
Where
Ronnie had texted me and goes, hey, what's happening here? And I was like, what do you mean what's happening? I don't know the guy that runs TikTok.
Yeah.
He was like, our song is being played all over the place. It's got some mix. And then now there's like a dance to it. But it is really cool to see.
Oh, I got to check that out.
And it's the easiest dance too. And some of those dances I look at and I can't do. But it's like that song, Mike, the remix everywhere, isn't it?
Everywhere.
I'm a Survivor and Neon Moon are probably, other than Walker Hayes' Fancy like the two biggest songs on TikTok.
Fun.
But it's just cool to see, I wouldn't even say every, you know, generation, which I would say like 10 years, but it's like you just stay relevant. And if someone comes to you and says, you know, what's the key to staying, how do you do it?
How do I do it?
I don't do it.
I don't do nothing. I've got a great team that come up. They're young. They can think of great things for me to do. And I just go do it. And thank God fans like that thought it was interesting enough to sit on a toilet seat and change the roll of toilet paper and then turn into Reba and good job. You know, I'm a survivor. It's just cute things like that. I'm very flattered. More than anything, the songwriters. I mean, I text them and I sent the TikTok over to them saying, look what's going on for y'all's song. So it's something we can all share and celebrate with. But it is so good, and it proves one thing: a great song will live forever.
The you did a whole album with different remixes on it.
Yeah.
Was the remix album inspired by it kind of blowing up again, or were you already in the works with that before it blew up on TikTok?
Cindy Mabe came up with the idea of revisiting the catalog. And so their team, my team, they all got together and started coming up. I mean, the first time we all sat at a long conference table and they were telling me the ideas. Was that 2 years ago or a year ago?
At least two
when we could without masks. And I was like, oh, crap, they're serious. They've got a lot of ideas here. And after the first 50, I was like, man, this is cool. And after that, I was like, oh, crap, I'm going to be way busier than I want to be probably. But they were coming up with all these ideas and then the three albums and three ways of doing Fancy. And I thought it was just genius. And so here we are promoting it now.
Did you feel precious about, okay, I know you want to remix these songs, but to a lot of people, these songs, you know, define, you know, different parts of their life. Or were you like, hey, have at it. I'm curious to see what you guys do with the remix.
The latter. I was saying, go for it. Then when they said I'm a survivor as a dance mix, I said, really? But it turned out great.
It's fun to look at your top streaming songs. Fancy's number one. Of all the, when we went through all the different services, kind of added them all up, Fancy's number one. And I never, and I'm sure that you've heard this many times, whenever I was singing Fancy as a kid, I never really knew what Fancy was about until I got to be an adult. And then when I found out what Fancy was about, I was like, wow, I've been singing that song a little too passionately. Like, because I was singing it hard. Uh-huh. I mean, I was really into it. And then it's like, one day you just go,
oh,
huh, how about that?
How about that? Yeah, the little girl coming to school and wanting to sing Fancy for the talent night. And she goes, do you know what this is about? She's, yeah, she gets a brand new red dress from her mama. Okay.
And then, okay, if that's what you think it's about, that's great.
Have at it.
So when you recorded that song, was there any talk with your team, like, ooh, this is kind of an area that we're going to be singing about that maybe isn't talked about a whole lot in contemporary country music?
Well, when I was with Jimmy Bowen in the 80s, he said, is there a song you want to do a remix on? And I said, yeah, Fancy. He said, oh, woman, you don't need to be doing that. That's about a prostitute. I said, I'm totally aware of that. And so when I went with Tony Brown in 1990, he said, would you like to do a song again? And I said, Fancy. He said, oh, my gosh, that's my favorite song. So we did it.
So it had been discussed years earlier.
Uh-huh.
And you decided not to cover it.
But well, then, I was vetoed.
Yeah.
It was like, nope. Can't do that.
Well, this whenever the night the lights went out in Georgia, which I know that song because of Mama's Family, and then, you know, doing research on her and realizing she was a singer. Yeah, Vicki Lawrence.
Yeah.
When you do that song, was it similar, or did you go, yeah, we're just going to do it and right away?
Same thing. Tony said, is there another song you'd like to do a remix, to do it again? And I said, yeah, that's the night the lights went out in Georgia. And you know, Vicki, that was her one and only song she recorded, went number one. Isn't that amazing?
Do you have a conversation with a person if they're alive? Like, did you talk to Vicki?
I did.
And what was her thoughts? Like, have at it?
Oh, she was thrilled to death, yeah. But it was after I did it when I talked to her. Remember, she had that talk show,
mm-hmm,
TV talk show, and I went on and visited with her, and we sang it together on the show.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I would assume even for you that would be pretty cool, and you get to do everything cool.
Oh, everything I get to do cool, I am thrilled to death about it. I don't take it for granted.
Still after all this time?
Yeah.
You're not jaded?
Oh, no, no. When I got to do the video with Dolly Parton, I was like, I was the biggest fan in the room.
You know, it's wild to hear someone who I look at as being the greatest, you.
Oh.
And to look at Dolly at the greatest.
She is.
And to know that you would walk into a room with her and be like, in awe.
Yeah.
When you moved to Nashville, where was was Dolly available when you moved to Nashville? Or was she in L.A.? Was she in that phase?
I have no idea.
You don't know?
I don't know. First time I saw Dolly was September 17th, 1977.
You remember
in
the
person.
You remember the year and the day?
The day, the hour. I was going to go on and do my first performance at the Grand Ole Opry. And they came up and said, we're going to take one of your songs away from you. You only do one. And I said, why? I said, well, Dolly Parton just pulled in the parking lot. And I said, well, she can take both of them. Can I meet her? And she walked by in this chiffon black pantsuit and had those rhinestone butterflies on and this big cotton candy hair. I thought, man, that must be what angels look like. That was the most beautiful woman I ever saw in my life.
And did you say hello?
No.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I was backed up against the wall like everybody else was. I mean, they said, part the waves, Dolly's coming in, and I slammed back up against that wall and just watched. I don't think her feet touched the ground. She was an angel.
And when did you guys have your first, you know, where we kind of do the same thing experience?
Years later. Yeah. And then she came on the Reba TV show, and we got to spend the whole week together. That was precious. I absolutely love that. Priceless.
I just look at you two as cut out of the same cloth, where you're as country as can be.
Yep.
You have ambitions that are bigger than just singing country music. Although that's your most important, that's your pillar.
Mm-hmm.
You have ambitions other than just that. And you both did it at a really high level.
Yeah.
And I would think that hopefully she would be someone, same thing with like Taylor to you. you know, with some of these other artists who are doing that, that you could reach out to after a point and get advice from her. Did that ever happen? Where you reach out and like, Dolly, you know, can I pick your brain at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have done that. I did that in the early 90s, a phone call, and she took my call. Matter of fact, I called her. She was at, I think, Caesars in Vegas, and I was in Bakersfield somewhere, and I needed a piece of advice from her. And she was on the Tonight Show the night before, and she said she's going to Vegas, won't be at Caesars. So I called Caesars.
Actually called the casino?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I said, I need to speak to Dolly Parton, please. She said, one moment, please. Who's calling? I said, Reba McEntire. And pretty soon Dolly came on the line. She said, is this really Reba McEntire or some squirrel that wishes she was Reba McEntire? I said, it's me.
That's funny to think about. We used to have to call. I mean, I haven't thought about having to do that where you just had to call a place to get someone. You used to have to call a restaurant and be like, hey, is my uncle there?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like back in the day.
Yeah.
I want to play a little clip of Does He Love You? This is you and Dolly. Let me hear this here.
Oh, does he love you?
Does he love you?
Like he loves me.
Like he loves me.
Does he think of you?
Does he think of you?
When he's holding me.
How cool is that to hear, even though you've heard it 10,000 times?
Yeah, you're right, because when we first heard it, Dave Cobb was the one that produced this one, and when we were going down the list of all the songs and listening to them, and Does He Love You came up, and I sat there and listened. I said, play it again, and we listened to it again. It was just the best.
Can I ask about the original version? Because from me moving to Nashville, I've gotten to know Linda, Hillary's mom.
Yeah.
Pretty well. Like,
yeah.
I love her.
Yeah.
But I remember watching on CMT you guys' video. It was one of the video that and probably Prop Me Up Beside the Jukebox When I Die are probably the two that I really, you know, remember and think about from kind of that part of my life. But originally, I had read that you thought maybe Wynonna would be the one. But Linda killed it, singing it. And you're like, we have to go with that. Is that story true?
Well, partially. Linda was on the road with me. She and Hillary's dad, Lang Scott, they were on the road with me, and I thought, Linda, we could do this every night on stage because she's a backup singer. I was featuring her on some songs because she had a record deal. And so Tony said, the record label, of course, wanted either Trisha or Wynonna. And I said, but it's right here. It's so handy. And they said, well, let's keep working on it. And I said, well, in the meantime, while I'm recording it, can Linda just step in and do the other part so I have somebody to sing against? They said, okay. And when she got through, Tony said she got the part.
Did you tell her then, hey, you're just going to sing this as kind of a demo version?
Yeah.
Do you think in her mind she was like, I'm going to sing this so good that hopefully they can't refuse it?
You know, Linda is so honest and so innocent. She was just probably glad to be there and just... I don't know what was in her mind, but I knew she would kill the song, love it. And, all Linda has to do is sing, and she sells herself. It's wonderful.
Did you know that Dolly would say yes if you asked her to do that?
No.
Did you worry she wouldn't say yes?
Yeah, that's why I said managers talk to managers.
Yeah.
I didn't want to put Dolly on the spot. Besides, I don't have her phone number. So I thought it would be a good idea just to go. And that way she had an out if she didn't want to do it.
The new box set, Revived, Remixed, Revisited, is out now. That is on the box set. Yeah, you're also doing the Christmas in Tune, which is the Lifetime movie. Where does acting rank on your passions now?
I love to act. I don't like to sit around, hurry up and wait. I don't like that part of it. But I'm doing several episodes of Young Sheldon on CBS. I love to do that. I love the acting. I love the preparation. I love to memorize my lines. I like almost all of it. I like the being an executive producer. I like being at the beginning. I like to rewrite. And if they let me do that once in a while, and they were really nice on Christmas in Tune to let me do that. Rex helped me tremendously, my boyfriend, Rex Lynn. He'd make me rehearse every day. I knew not only my lines, but I knew everybody else's lines because he would be every other character and I'd be me. So it was fun. I was very prepared for that role.
Whenever you started to do Reba, your television series, did you guys get a straight deal or did you do a pilot and then the pilot got picked up? Do you remember?
I'm getting them all mixed up because then we did Malibu Country. I was in the midst of doing Annie Get Your Gun we went in April. I took 10 days off from Annie Get Your Gun to go to California, shoot the pilot. Then we went to Upfronts, which is in May, and I had done 8 shows that week. I got Monday off. Tuesday morning was Upfronts, so I had to be butt crack of dawn over there. And they changed the name 3 times. When we filmed the show for the pilot, it was the script was called Sally. And Narva went to him and said, you know, if you did the afternoon filming as Sally and then in front of the audience, tape it and Reba be Reba instead of Sally, then let's see how that tests out. And they said, okay. So the title went from Sally. By the time I got to Upfronts, it was Deep in the Heart, because we were all from Houston, Texas, and we were the Hart family. So then there came out this thing on USA Today that their publicist had said why the WB had ever hired Reba McEntire for this part is ridiculous. She's not of our, people that watch.
Like our demo?
Yeah, she's not our demographics. And so the head of the company called by the time we got back to the hotel after Upfronts and said, terribly sorry, terribly sorry. What can we do to make up for this? Well, I'd already gone back to bed. I had a performance that night. So Narva was talking to her, and he heard me get up and go to the bathroom and out of the other room. And he said, hang on, let me put Reba on the line. He banged on the bathroom door and said, pick up the phone. I said, hello. He said, we're terribly sorry what happened and what was in the USA Today. What can we do to make this up to you? And I was half asleep, and I said, she said, well, Narva said if we call it Reba, you'll be happy with that. And I said, that's a wonderful idea. Thank you. Hung up, went back to bed. So that's how I got the name Reba.
And so you go, did you move out to L.A.?
Uh-huh.
Because it was that, like you said, hey, I just got to go. If I'm going to do this, I don't need to visit it. I need to go live it.
Oh, we were there 3 weeks. So what happened was I got through with Annie Get Your Gun on June 23rd. We went to Ireland for a vacation. I did 5 weeks all-girl tour and then went to L.A., found an apartment, a condo we lived in for the first season, because you never know.
Right.
It could go 13 weeks and you don't get picked up. But then we got picked up on the back nine. And then Narva went house hunting and we bought a house. And we were there for 6.5 seasons.
Did that ever feel like home out there?
Oh, yeah. I loved living in L.A. I'd love to go back and do another show.
Would you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Have you guys, you know, explored different versions of that?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been close?
Uh-huh. Real close.
Have you shot a pilot to anything?
Yeah. The Mark Cherry pilot. We did one called Oxblood, and they passed on it.
It's always a weird thing, because I've shot a few pilots and had it passed on, where you feel like everybody's so pumped about it.
Yeah.
And everybody loves it. But then mine have been talk shows. And like, oh, this is it. Research has been great.
Yeah.
It's tested so wonderfully. Well, let's spend some money. Well, just right now. Well, right. So is that show, that show's done?
That show's done, okay. Unfortunately, which I thought it was going to, you know, last forever. I thought I'd retire off of that show.
Well, I mean the Oxblood, that show.
That's it.
Yeah,
Yeah. Mark Cherry.
Yeah.
I love his show now, Why Women Kill. It's just, he is a genius.
I saw my wife watching that show one day and I was like, why are you watching? Why? I don't know what it was about.
Just all exactly what was, are your yes, motives?
Like, why are we learning from this
and
show?
And what's the notepad? And you're taking
yes,
notes.
Yes. What, my favorite duet in country music, the Cowgirls Don't Cry. That song to me, I think, is the saddest. We're in the land of sad songs. I mean, we have the format of the greatest sad songs of all time because I think we have the format of the realest songs of all time. Cowgirls Don't Cry, that song to me, and maybe it's because I just didn't have a dad growing up. Maybe it hits me like that. And I'm not a cowgirl, but you know, there's that relationship. Like when you heard that song, like were you moved?
Oh, yes, because I am a cowgirl and my daddy was a cowboy and a very strict cowboy. And so when we do that song on stage in Vegas, there is a huge screen behind the stage, behind the setup, and I'm walking on stage for my part, and Ronnie and Kix are already out there, and I happen to look up and see that cowboy. I barely got my notes out. It choked me up so bad.
I mean, that song still does it. Anytime we do, or anytime someone's interviewing me about country music and they're talking about emotion and song, like that's the one I still go to after all these years. And, and you know, we could list 50 great sad songs. But that one to me, and maybe it's the time of when it comes and how it hits me personally. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even a cowgirl. Like I said, I have no cowgirl in me. When you're out on tour, and we will end with this, she'll be out January. Do you feel like you've put an unhealthy expectation of you having to wear all the great clothes all the time?
Yes.
Don't you ever just want to go in sweats and be like, yes, I'm going to sing you 8 songs in sweats?
I'll never forget seeing Shania Twain come out. I wasn't there in person, but I saw it. And she had those fluffy little workout pants on and tennis shoes and her hair up in a ponytail. And I was like, I'm way overthinking this. And she had all her dancers bebopping around and it was so cool. And I thought, man, why didn't I think of that?
Okay. Thank you, Reba.
Thank you, Bobby. Right. Nice to see all of you.
That was awesome.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your next stop before attending your next concert. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring. You're talking about men's boots, women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition, timeless style, always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort, little to no break-in period. Like, it's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Plus, direct-to-consumer pricing keeps the value on your feet, the money in your pocket. So stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop the new styles. You like the smell of leather or no?
I love it.
Yeah. That's what the whole store basically is. Fresh leather.
Yep.
Friendly staff. Or like the smell of staff?
I don't know. I guess I'm sure they smell good there.
Many stores have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. What a gift, too. Regular live music and events. There is no in-store experience like this. If you can't make it to a store, just visit tecovas.com.
Tecovas.com. Tecovas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. I just want to say thanks to everybody who has stepped up for the kids at St. Jude. St. Jude's been leading the way in the world's best survival rates for some of the most aggressive forms of childhood cancer. Your support means that families never get a bill from St. Jude for treatment or travel or housing or food, so the families can focus on helping their child live. And that really hits home for me because I've been to St. Jude many times. I've hung out with the kids, played music for the kids. I was in the hospital a lot as a kid. Now, I didn't have cancer, but if it wasn't for people stepping up, I don't know that I would have been able to go and stay in the hospital and be taken care of. So that's why we do this, take care of others. You can help St. Jude stop childhood cancer by becoming a partner in hope. When you do this, you'll get this awesome new This Shirt Saves Lives shirt. So join all the doctors and researchers, you know, and me in this fight, and just text the word Bobby to 785-833. It's only 6 numbers, but text the word Bobby to 785-833.
And at number one, the best Bobby cast of 2021, it's going to Brothers Osborne. I think this is the one we had the most messages about ever when it came out. The day it went live, the response was like enormous. I think it's because this episode in particular went back to kind of the roots of this podcast. In the early episodes, in the early phases of the Bobbycast, I think the really great episodes are ones that felt like a therapy session. A lot of times in the early interviews, people would cry. That was kind of a thing, that the conversation would get so in-depth to the point to where some people would forget they were talking into a microphone, and it was just Bobby and the guests having this really kind of heartfelt conversation, and we got to know them so well that it felt like a therapy session. And there was one point in this episode that I think we kind of all forgot there was microphones in front of everybody's faces, and it was just Brothers Osborne and Bobby having this very genuine conversation. So the best episode of the year, and I think one of the best episodes that we've ever done on the podcast. So at number one, the top interview of 2021 on the Bobbycast, Brothers Osborne.
In studio now with Brothers Osborne. The first time that I saw you guys, I had been dragged to what they call a radio show boot camp.
Yes.
And it wasn't about country music. Heck, I wasn't even in country music. I had built my own syndication company, and I was doing pop and hip hop, but I was getting in trouble because I would put Dirks on, I put Willie on. They'd be like, why are you playing country music on pop radio? Kind of what it happens now, just on the other side, where I'll bring in Pharrell, or I'll bring in somebody, and they're like, why are you bringing in Pharrell on a country? Mm-hmm. I just always knew what I liked. It didn't matter to me really what format it was.
I think most people are that way.
I think people are too, right? Mm-hmm. But I was over there doing that, and we're in this theater, and I was ready for some other, you know, jabroni to get up and talk about something in radio that I thought was lame. And they were like, all right, before we go, we got these two guys we want to showcase to you. I think it was Chicago.
It was in Chicago, yeah.
And they were like,
I'll never forget this. This is one of the most awkward moments in our life.
It was awful.
For both of us, guys.
Yeah, that's good
to
hear.
They were like, awful. Brothers Osborne. And I was like, music? Like, I'm trying to, like.
And I also don't know if you recall this, but they said, Brothers Osborne. And then the guy decides in that moment to change the batteries in the microphones. Oh, I'm like, why didn't you do this like 10 minutes ago, dude? Are you kidding me? So we had to stand there on stage while everyone had been, they had finished clapping 5 minutes ago, and he's changing one by one these batteries. I was like, oh my God, I could kick you straight off the stage right now. And we started performing and no one really cared. Can I say another thing though about that I found really bizarre about that?
Yeah,
since you worked in different like formats of radio, why are the pop radio people so insanely arrogant? Like, I feel like a lot of them
pop
have stations.
Pop artists are too.
But I find like these people, you know, like, I feel like it's probably unusual in country. Like, you actually do know most, if not all, the country artists that come through here. But they always pretend like you'll listen to a pop station, they'll be like, oh, yeah, I was hanging with my boy Drake. And I'm like, I guarantee that you maybe just saw him in a meet and greet. And it's so weird. And they're like the most and at that thing, I found it almost like unbearable to watch these people coexist together, because you had the country people who were like really cool and hanging out, and some of them have their egos, and then all the pop people were like, screw the country guys. Even though I'm like, these guys have stations that are like five times the size of yours. I don't know why that happens, but it's weird.
Culture. The answer is culture. You are in the pop world taught to look as cool as you absolutely can, even if you don't have it. In the country world, and I find this with myself too, because I'm in California a lot working. In the country world, or the Nashville world, or the South, or however you want to use, you know, we are taught, hey, even if you are cool, kind of scale it back a little bit, because nobody gives a crap.
Nobody does.
So it's basically that's the difference. Pop radio versus Los Angeles versus Nashville versus country radio. It's when I go and I'm shooting American Idol, they think that I am, first of all, showing up with a hazy, you know, overalls hazy.
Yeah, but they're
also like, he's just the greatest guy. And it's like, I'm like everybody else here. You know, I don't get an award for being the greatest guy. I'm a good dude, but
everybody, you gotta be a good dude
around here or you don't survive.
Yeah,
I know. Isn't that weird when someone's like,
they'll prune the bad dudes here.
Oh, big time.
Real quick.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, he's just the greatest. Because there, if you don't show up with an entourage, even if you can't afford it, that's anti that culture that they promote. So that's such a wonderful observation that you saw, because that's how it is.
Here, if you show up with an entourage, everyone's laughing at you.
Like, yeah, they're like,
what are you
douche.
Doing?
Yeah.
Boo. Everyone's like rolling their eyes. I mean, that's like in the same way that Vince Gill, arguably the greatest singer and songwriter musician of all time, of all genres, shows up by himself to like an event and wears his lanyard around his neck with his name on it just to make sure that everyone, he can get backstage to a place he's playing. And then he's just cool, and then he packs up his own guitar and walks off and drives his own ass home. I'm like, wow. If he can do it, anyone can do it.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I saw Stapleton drive up to a show once in his old truck in Nashville, get out, be like, hey, I'm Chris. And they were like, oh, you are him. And they just like let him in. He just literally, Stapleton drove his old truck, parked it behind the Ryman, and walked in the back just to do his show.
Yeah.
And I was like, but yes, it's a culture.
Yeah.
People in that pop culture have to act cooler than they are. People in this culture have to act less cool than they
are. And you really see it too at the Grammy Awards. I feel like it's so funny. Once again, you'll see someone from country walk in and everyone's like, oh, this hokey, you know, SOB. Meanwhile, I'm like, this dude sells like 10 times the amount of tickets you do. Like, you're not that cool. Yeah. Like, just chill, you know, just have fun. Why is it such a, you know, it's weird that they're like, oh, wow, they're so nice. I'm like, Shouldn't you just be that way? Nice?
And I felt that way too early, but now I just take it. I'm like, I'm the nicest guy in Hollywood. Here I am. Because I would go to
a weirdo.
I would go to meetings where, and I didn't realize that it was so counter that culture, but I would go to meetings and pitch TV shows, not for me, because I produce a couple shows. And I would go and I'd be like, I met with Les before I got in trouble. I went and met with Les Moonves, who was the president of CBS and all of his people. And I showed up by myself at the gate and I just, you know, took an Uber, got out, and they were like, you're here by yourself? Are we waiting for your team? I was like, I'm the team.
it's not that hard.
And they were just so shocked by it, and they said, they verbally said, this never happens. Nobody comes alone. This is so refreshing. And I went, oh, I will now do this forever.
Yeah.
So when I go, and that's what I would have done anyway, I go by myself.
Right.
And I show, I get my little backpack on, and I'm like, hello, hey, guys.
Yeah.
But they're like, you're the nicest guy in Hollywood. And I'm like, I'm not from Hollywood. So, but it is. It's definitely a culture thing. But you guys grew up, where you grew up in Maryland, I have to think felt like the South.
Compared to
compared
to New York and Boston and a place where I go when I'm in the Northeast. Yes.
100%.
I think it's interesting, and I think it's probably a lot of why our music is the way that it is it's like to the Northerners, we are just like these rednecks down where we're from, and then people from the South treat us like we're these Yankees, and it's kind of like we're in kind of everything. No one really wants to claim us. I'm not really sure what's going on, but it is a very like homogenous thing where we do feel part Northeast and part Southern. It's really, really strange.
That's funny you say no one wants to claim you, because I felt for a while, and I'm not just saying this because you're here, I have been fans of you guys since the first time I heard you. Mm. I was just like, love you guys. And yeah. I would tell you guys that, and I'd bring you on the show, mm-hmm. and you play early stuff. And
you've been very supportive.
And this isn't me, I don't want to hurt my elbow, pat myself on the back. But my point is that I felt like even the format, country music did that to you for a minute too. Not geographically,
absolutely.
But they're like, they're a little too rock. And then they'll be like, no, they're a little too country. Mm-hmm. Where you kind of were in that same spot where no one wanted to claim you exactly. Mm-hmm. Did you feel that way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Still do.
Still do. Yeah.
Still
but
do.
I think, you know, the thing is that we've realized, I think there's a lot of fans out there who are the same for whatever reason. And it's actually been, now that we are where we are, I think we've done really well touring because of that, and we've been able to make a lot happen off of comparatively not a ton of radio success. And I think obviously to a new artist, we have had a decent amount of radio success, but we've gotten a lot done with not much. And and to come full circle though, you mentioned something, and we were kind of heading there with your story, talking about that radio seminar thing that was extremely bizarre. And I've told you this before. But we just got to meet you. I think you were new to country, so everyone was like, I don't know about this guy. You know, he's like fresh blood. Everyone's like, and you're immediately coming into like one of the biggest like slots in radio. But you sat there through the entirety of our performance.
You did.
Most people could care less that we were playing. There was very few people in the room that paid attention. And I will always remember that you were
same.
Attentive to the entire thing. Whether it was because you felt incredibly sorry for us, I'm not really sure. That probably had a lot to do with it. But thanks, Bobby. Thank you.
You talk about it's, you know, when you say we haven't had, as compared to a new artist, a lot of radio success. It's funny because there are some songs that will hit number four, but feel like a number one.
Yeah.
With some artists, right? Not even talking about you guys specifically, but Urban will come in, and I think like. Gonna Fly or something was never a number one. Or he's like, you know, but it feels like a number one because people remember. I feel like, because I had to look at like the chart to see where you, I feel like you guys get more credit for having radio success because it feels like a lot of your songs were bigger than maybe numerically they were given.
I know, it's really
strange.
Does that make sense? Oh, 100%.
And
yeah.
You are right that way. There's a really kind of one of my favorite sayings amongst radio promos people is they always say, not every hit is a number one, and not every one number one is a hit. And, you know, it is weird. And John and I just rack our brains all the time thinking about that. Some artists have a bunch of number ones, and you can't remember them. And then some people have hardly any number ones, but you remember all of their material. And I don't know why it works that way, but I definitely feel that way for us. And that was why I really particularly missed playing in front of a crowd for a year and a half, is for us, like a song like All Night, we felt like that would be a big hit. It did okay, but now that we're out playing it, it's like you would have thought the song was at number one for a month. I mean, people go bananas for it. Now, it was really hard for us I think it went to like 20 on the charts or something like that.
25.
That felt like with this rejection. But usually John and I don't pay a whole lot of attention to that because we're seeing it live and we're like, okay, it's working. But now that we are back at it, I'm like, okay, now I get, you know, what we do, why we do what we do, because it works. And it was extremely hard for us in the pandemic to just only be able to look at a chart position.
That was the one, who knows what chart I'm looking at here. I think this was maybe Media Base?
Yeah.
Okay, so All Night was one of the ones that I specifically pulled and was like, this thing was only in the 20s?
Yeah.
Like, here's a clip of All Night. Another one was, and I bet you that it just lights up a live show. It Ain't My Fault.
Yeah.
I got to imagine hands come up and that.
Oh, yeah, every night.
It is. Well, yeah.
I got to imagine people hit this song as hard as any number one live.
Well, oh, yeah. The thing is, our biggest, which does very well, our biggest song on the chart position-wise or whatever was Stay a Little Longer. But people come, the majority of the crowd, the song they're waiting to hear is this one. I mean, it ain't my fault.
Yeah. It's the one that they call for the most. You know, Stay a Little Longer, being our only number one, people love that song, but they stay for All Night. They want to hear it, but they stay for that one.
And right now, we're on to our current single, I'm Not for Everyone, and it's charting, we're doing pretty good, but we're like, hello, can we get moving here? Like, this, we're still just like hanging in the 40s, like, what's going on? But now that we're going out and we can play it, and people are already responding like we're playing a hit song, it's like, okay, it's just, there's other things at play here more than just a chart position. It's a huge part of what we do, but it's not the only thing, and it can be, it can drive, I think it drives, even artists that have lots of number ones, if you just look at a chart, it really will just eat you from the inside out. It's really frustrating.
Especially from like the 42 to 31 spot. That's kind of like the swampy no man's land.
Oh my God, it's
where you're
awful.
Just trying to climb out.
Yeah.
And if you can get out, you got a shot.
And then if you're looking at the chart, especially being in this business now for as long as we have, it's like we know nearly everyone that's on the charts.
When they're jumping
over us.
Your
friend jump you, you're like, oh God, I'm canceling dinner with you.
I think it all comes down to like, what's your own metric, you know? And there are people that live and die by the chart, and that's fine if that's your metric and that's what you base your success on. That's fine. That's how you want to do it, and it's great. I think for us, we have to base our own success off of multiple metrics. One of them is how well we're doing on radio, but most importantly, like TJ touched on earlier, is how many butts are you putting in seats, and two, how much fun are they having, and how much fun are they having during that song? Can you feel the energy? And we have to go off of that metric. You know, we're very grateful for how we've done on country radio, considering that we do sound different. And it has helped us immensely. But if we only hung our hat on just the chart, we would lose our minds, which is honestly why I don't even look at it. I mean, I don't, because what the hell can I do? I mean, right? I'm not going to call a radio promoter or some guy up and be like, hey, can you give me like 5 spins? That's what our promo team's for. It's just going to drive me crazy. But every time they do play a song, it is a little advertisement for our band.
And there's also this really strange disconnect with radio. And as John said, to me, I think the ultimate just stat is just tickets. You sell tickets.
Yeah.
I haven't learned the TikTok dance yet to your new song. So if you guys want
to. Yeah, it's not happening.
No, yes.
No.
Okay.
It's not happening.
I guess that's why I haven't learned it. You haven't made it yet.
We should do a TikTok dance where you just sit, stand still. Be like, everyone can do this.
Yeah.
What? So the tour, we're not for everyone.
Yes. Yeah, we're not for
everybody. Everyone. We're not for everyone tour. So did you name, because it's always you name a song, in the record, after the song, after the tour. In what order did that happen? And did you name the tour this because you really felt that or because it was a good song? Or
well, a couple different reasons. I mean, we titled the record Skeletons because honestly, the song Skeletons on that record defined, I think, the record. It's kind of the centerpiece, the keystone.
Was it the first one we recorded?
It's one of the first ones we cut.
I know.
And then we recorded I'm Not for Everyone. It was one of the last songs, if not the last song that we recorded. We thought, oh, we got one more day. Let's just do this song. And I'm like, we were thinking, man, I'll sing a verse. That might be kind of cool. It'll just be different. It'll never be a single, but the fans will like it. And then we put the record out, and then people started freaking out about this song in particular. And I think it has a lot to do with the message. I mean, you look at the times that we're in now, and everyone is claiming, you know, who they are, and this is what I do. And also, like, coming to terms with the fact that you just can't please everybody, especially in 2020 and 2021. So we felt the traction of the song, so we decided, you know, we got to put it out. And then it is a bit of our mantra. We are accepting that we just are not for everybody. You look at our songs getting to 20 at best for the most part. And then getting to Neil and Travis, who are both a very unique, very awesome left of center artists, it just kind of worked. The whole message seemed to come together at one time. I wish I could say that we were smart enough to see in the future like that, but we're not. And it's just, but we saw how the thing was shaping up and we took advantage of it.
Yeah. And I think it is one of those things that John and I wrote it from the perspective of this is how we feel. And to our surprise, I think nearly everyone feels that way.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote some very personal things in my first book. And I thought, oof, I'm going to share some stuff that's extremely vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it had to do with either the drug addiction my mom had before she died or a lot of the really bad decisions that she made that influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
And that I loved her, but it was a very tough relationship. I mean, heck, she got pregnant when she was 15, right? Mm-hmm. And my dad left.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had to, but I was going, there was a lot of stuff. And even when she reached her breaking point, she did some things that I know she wouldn't be proud of, but because she, drugs had a, taken control of her.
Yeah.
And so I wrote, and in that I was trying to tell the story of someone who had been through that, not through her side of it, but through mine. And I've never had a drink of alcohol, never touched a drug because I've been so scared of it. I wish I could. I mean, and that to me, the one thing I want to do is relax. I'm freaking wild. So, but I wrote these stories and I thought, man, either people are going to feel sorry for me or they're going to tell me to shut up, but they're not going to understand. And I put it out. And what I learned is, and I say this because you just expressed the same thing to me. What I learned was I never felt so welcomed or like I was included until I felt like I was so not included.
Yeah.
I thought, this is my story. No one's going to understand. Nobody's going to relate. Nobody's going to feel like me.
Yeah.
But it turns out that just because people aren't screaming about it doesn't mean they're not feeling it.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when you say we're not for everyone, we do. That's how I felt about me, but I would be doing a meet and greet somewhere. You know, we'd be on, I'd be doing, someone would come up, hey, he's like, you know, the story about, you know, like that touched me. And I was I
felt that severely when I came out. It was, you know, I thought, I didn't know how it would be received. I knew some people would be supportive and some people would probably hate, but I think the thing that was really one of the most like recharging things of it or whatever, or inspiring things to me, were the parents and stuff being like, hey, my kid.
Other kids.
Are being like, this is great. You know, I was getting a lot of that kind of stuff of just people who themselves weren't gay, but were really close to someone who was. And this felt like just like a relief for them. And that, yeah. So I know what you mean. It was, I didn't expect that. And it was one of the coolest experiences I've ever felt.
Did you feel more love? And you just said this, but I just want to hear this from you again, because I did. Did you feel more love than you expected?
I did, and you know, I've talked about this before, but I absolutely felt more love than I expected, and I even feeling the love from people that I knew loved me. It was so different. It was so overwhelming, and it's a thing I wish everyone got to experience because everyone is loved more than they realize they are. And the kind of sad part is a lot of people don't talk about how much they love someone until they've like died or something really tragic. Yeah. And you know, it was a difference of just like someone, you know, it's like I compared to someone just leaves and like, all right, love you, man. See you later. As opposed to like someone grabbing you by the shoulders and being like, I love you. Like, and it just was like, wow, it's the same word, but it just hit in such a different way. Mm-hmm. That I just thought in that moment, wow, like just for this alone to feel this is, it's something I wish everyone could feel at some point in time.
Why at that point in time, like, did you guys have a conversation like, let's just do it now, where you finally like, I just feel like telling people?
Well, yeah, I mean, I always wanted to come out, and this was a huge hurdle for me because I was always really really afraid that it would look opportunistic, and so I never wanted it to be anything that would just not here we need some publicity or whatever. And so in order to do that, I always felt like I need to do this at the height of my career. And then through the pandemic, I'm like, yeah, I just really, one, was kind of the things that were important to me were very simple things that I've had virtually my whole life. Was doing the same, sitting around fire or having some drinks, just, you know, chewing the fat with people. That was, I mean, the things that I was still having the same that were fun for me. And I'm like, I can do this, you know, when I was broke, I was doing these same exact things, you know. So I just felt like at that point, I'm like, and then also, who knows when you're at the height of your career? And so then the other fear was, what if I have to, you never know that you're have passed the height of your career until you're on the way down. And then if I come out then, it just seems like I'd be jumping the shark to people. And so I just felt kind of stuck in this weird thing of like, I'm unsure the perfect time. And then finally, just one day, I just thought like, I got to do this. Like, and I got to do it now. And I don't want to go back to work to where I just have distractions again. Like, I need to do this now where I can focus on it. And the other thing too was I want to be able to build my, why would I not want to get to the height of my career being just completely open about who I am and what I am. And John and I really pride ourselves for just being who we are. I mean, hell, it's where our songs, I'm not for everyone. It's kind of like their mission statement, so to speak. And so at that point, I was like, it needs, I don't know that there ever is a perfect time, and there really isn't in your brain until you do it, and then you realize that that was the perfect time.
Just appreciate you guys, and I'll see you soon.
Likewise, buddy.
Take care.
And that was the top 8 Bobbycast interviews of 2021. My name is Mike D. Thanks for hanging out with me. Be sure to subscribe so you get brand new episodes coming in 2022. Be sure to subscribe so you get brand new episodes of the Bobbycast starting in 2022. Hit that follow button, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening to this right now. If you happen to be listening on Apple Podcasts, you can leave that 5-star rating and write a quick little review, because it helps us out to get more people to listen to this podcast. And if you're looking for a completely different podcast to listen to, I host a podcast called Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. You got spoiler-free movie reviews, interviews with actors and directors. Basically, the same passion that Bobby has for music, I have for movies, so you can check out that podcast. My name is Mike D. Follow me on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok at Mike Destro. That's Mike, D-E-E-S-T-R-O. And we will see you in 2022 here on the Bobbycast.
This festival and concert season will be all about the boots. And Tecovas is your stop before attending your next concert. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. Stop by your local Tecovas store. Have a complimentary drink. Shop new styles. If you can't make it to a store, just visit Tecovas.com. T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. You can probably spell it. You probably know it. Tecovas.com. Find your new favorite pair of boots today. This is the year to stop overpaying for your family plan. So choose a Straight Talk Wireless family plan. Unlimited data, talk, and text on a reliable 5G network. And you can get a new line starting at $25 per line per month for 4 lines, plus taxes and fees and no contracts. That's good decision making. Available at Walmart and on straighttalk.com. Family plan discount with 4 lines, all on the Silver Unlimited plan. Not combinable with auto pay discount. In times of traffic, your data may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Video streams at up to 480p.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.